Good afternoon, everybody, and happy Gondorian New Year. It is the 25th of March, on which the whole Kingdom of Gondor will be celebrating the beginning of the new year, starting at the beginning of the Fourth Age. So here we are on March 25th. And so today we're going to return to Tolkien and Tolkien adaptation. And so, of course, Maggie and I were thinking a lot about the discussion of Tolkien adaptation in The Lord of the Rings that we have begun in a really fun video project that we are working on. We are joined by a special guest, Ben Davis from Studio Lab, New Hampshire. Hey, Ben, welcome.
Hey.
Of course, as you can see, Ben and Maggie are like actually sitting shoulder to shoulder because Maggie is here with us in the state of New Hampshire today. So
I'm in the same time zone. I'm in the same room with somebody. It's amazing. There's no dog interrupting us. Can't wait.
That's it. Yeah. You can see the sunshine still shining on Maggie at this time of day. So yeah. Yeah. Ben, of course, is directing the video project, the sort of longer-term video project that we are working on, which is, of course, designed to be exploring The Lord of the Rings, going through the Peter Jackson films and thinking through the adaptation questions and stuff along the way. We've already done a good deal of work on the opening sequences, you know, the opening episodes of the show. We're sort of thinking about that today.
So it's not utterly different from what we do here, but it's a little bit more planned and a little bit more thoughtful. And it's in the studio. So obviously the production value is going to be a whole lot higher. So yes, it's been really fun. We've gotten together three or four times now to start. And I think we've probably got, like 3 or 4 hours of footage to cover about 6 pages of text.
That to the surprise of no one.
Right.
Exactly.
We do expect it to go a little bit faster than some other projects, but
it will. Yeah. And we're doing, but we've done many minutes of film in that time.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of minutes. So, you know, I think, the ratio is going to be good. We began, of course, with the prologue sequence, the Concerning Hobbits prologue sequence.
FYI, I do have that.
Have a clip?
I do have a clip. Literally this second, it was just sent, so I haven't even looked at it yet. But if we want to show it, I've got a clip.
Cool. Do you want to begin with that? Do you want to begin with the text, or do you want to begin with that?
Let's begin with the text. That always sets our good foundation. And then we can all watch this clip together and be surprised and see if it has anything to do with the text we read. And then we can talk about outfits and
clip being received in real time from our production team. So, okay, there we go.
Great.
All right. So we'll start with the text. So this is how the prologue of the Lord of the Rings begins. 1. Concerning Hobbits. This book is largely concerned with hobbits, and from its pages a reader may discover much of their character and a little of their history. Further information will also be found in the selection from the Red Book of Westmarch that has already been published under the title of The Hobbit. That story was derived from the earlier chapters of the Red Book, composed by Bilbo himself, the first hobbit to become famous in the world at large, and called by him There and Back Again, since they told of his journey into the East and his return, an adventure which later involved all the hobbits in the great events of that age that are here related. Many, however, may wish to know more about this remarkable people from the outset, while some may not possess the earlier book. For such readers, a few notes on the more important points are here collected from hobbit lore, and the first adventure is briefly recalled. So this is Tolkien's frame for the prologue, which itself frames the entire narrative of The Lord of the Rings. And we can see several things that he's sort of doing with this prologue, and like both with his overall prologue and the way that he is getting into it here in the first couple paragraphs. And one of the things that is remarkable. So especially when thinking about the Peter Jackson adaptation, right, and the ways in which the opening moments of the film, leading him through the opening minutes of the film, the way that they address the viewers, right, the way that they frame us and our position there. There are some really interesting, I mean, we can see some very pronounced differences, which again, in my mind, so clearly point to some of the, what seemed to me, the native differences between the written format and the film format. Tolkien begins with this very academic tone, right? And of course, he writes with an academic tone. The sort of persona that he writes in these first couple paragraphs, he consistently maintains all the way through the prologue. And it seems to be the persona of a modern researcher who is our contemporary, speaking to us in our world about these historical texts, which he has not discovered, but has, you know, it's a little uncertain exactly what this particular scholar's role is. He's a translator, it seems. Certainly a kind of like the one who's sort of bringing it to the public. But he doesn't speak as if he doesn't say anything like, you know, no one will ever have heard this, or, you know, like, I am excited to introduce you for the first time to these things. Instead, he speaks as if everyone already knows about all of these things, and he's merely commenting on them, right? Notice the way that he says, further information will also be found in the selection from the Red Book of Westmarch that has already been published under the title of The Hobbit, as if everybody knows that already. Like, obviously, it's a given. Everyone knows what the Red Book of Westmarch is, and that a section of the Red Book of Westmarch has been published already under the title of The Hobbit is something well known to everybody. Right.
Yeah.
So he's framing it from the point of view of someone from the modern world. And I see, you know, Alan Wiles is, you know, talks about the prologue being written by Pippin for the people of Gondor. There are parts of it which are quite likely derived from a text that might have done that. Again, it's one of the things that he's going to be introducing throughout, is that there are all these different layers of sort of texts that he's working from and using as source materials. He may have, though Pippin was not, did not become the prolific writer of nonfiction that Mary became. However, it's possible that there are some notes or writings from Pippin that did survive and were used as sources. But the voice all the way through, it is not, we are not asked to enter into, like, the opening paragraphs do not ask us to enter imaginatively into the world of Middle-earth. They instead invite us to stand back and look at the world of Middle-earth, but also they ask us to take for granted the fact that the world of Middle-earth exists and is historical, right? Even to creating a certain amount of ambiguity when he says, for instance, composed by Bilbo himself, the first hobbit to become famous in the world at large. What world? The world of Middle-earth? Our world? Right? I mean, like, it's, I think, legitimately unclear what world he's referring to there, because they, because again, he's absolutely assuming from the beginning that all of these things are part of our world. When he refers to the great events of that age that are here related, right? There's no even allowance for the possibility that these things are fictional, right?
There's no leap being asked or required of the audience. It's just a statement of fact. Here's information.
Yes, information. Because everybody goes to The Hobbit for information. Right, like The Hobbit is preeminently a book of information that people go to, right? Further information will also be found, I think, is a delightful it's almost like a satire of The Hobbit, almost. You know, I mean, it's certainly kind of a joke. Not exactly a joke at his own expense, but a joke that he expects readers to to kind of participate in. Though I have to admit, I have clear memories of reading this prologue when I was like in middle school and high school. And I just like ate it up. Like, I didn't find that funny at all. I was just like, that's right. There is a good deal of information that you can get from
it. I don't even know if I would call it a joke. You know, it feels very, very factual to those of us that live and breathe this world. Like, well, yes, indeed.
Yes.
Of course.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's appropriate. Yes. No, absolutely. Yeah. I was at that age, I was like, yes, I have derived a great deal of information from the Hobbit, in fact. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. It's, it is. So when we look at the kinds of ways and the different kinds of levels in which Tolkien is writing and addressing us right here and involving us in this story, it's in a completely like that. It's really, really hard to do this sort of thing. You can do, you know, kind of metatextual stuff in films, right? You can break the fourth wall. But that's, even that concept, Maggie, the concept of breaking the fourth wall, you know, thinking about what that means in film compared to what doing a similar kind of thing means in like the context of a novel or just a written book.
Yeah, I don't know if I would even call this one breaking the fourth wall. Like, breaking the fourth wall, you feel like, is a tongue-in-cheek aside to the audience in film most of the time. Like, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's a narrative frame to give us. But so often, it's like, haha, did you see that? You know, it's like a joke to the audience to make sure you're paying attention or watching.
Right, like that that director's note in the Barbie film. Remember when like the director interrupts
saying they shouldn't have cast Margot Robbie because she's too beautiful and
right, exactly, like this would have been easier to believe, because it's at the point when Barbie is complaining about how unattractive and everything she is, and then the director's note interrupts it, right? And that's exactly that sort of aside interruption that doesn't like stop the proceedings, doesn't reroute things. Like, I'm thinking about, like, for instance, the way that the kind of right-hand turn that the end of Blazing Saddles takes, right? You know, with the... Like, it's not that kind of a disruption of the procedure, but it is this interruption, right?
It's a commentary. It's taking you into the room as opposed to you watching the room. You know, it's bringing you in. And in text, I mean, the most clear example I can think of is Princess Bride, because the author interjects himself and physically talks to you separate from the story that's going to be text. But, like, yeah, that's flat-out breaking the fourth wall. But to do it in this way, I guess you could say it's breaking the fourth wall because it's addressing us, but it's more of a narrative technique than it is, I think, an audience perception question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's to be doing metatextual things within the context of the written word. Is, again, I think it's just easier. I mean, like we talked recently in Dune about the Princess Irulan epigrams that we get in at the beginning of every chapter, right? Which introduces an entire metatextual level, right? The idea that this text is being taken from or adapted from or somehow connected with this set of texts which are historically situated within the world that it's talking about, you know. It's much easier and much more frequent, I think, to disrupt. So, like, when you're picking up a book and reading it, right, the thing that is happening that everybody assumes, like the default framework of the experience of picking up a book and reading it, is okay. It's a book of, you know, it's a book of fiction. So, okay. I am reading a story that was written by this person. So I'm going to now begin reading this work of fiction. And then I'm going to be engaging imaginatively with this work of fiction as it is unfolding. And it is understood that it is a work of that it is a work of fiction that someone has written and that I am reading, right? This is why the default assumption, this is why the third person omniscient narrator works, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't ask the question, by default, you don't ask the question, how do I know what this person was thinking, right?
Yeah.
Because the narrator knows, this person is writing the story and the person who's making up the story knows the answer to the question, right? So, but of course, again, there are so many ways to kind of tamper with that default set of assumptions. Even writing something in the first person creates mm-hmm. a metatextual situation, right?
And there's a reason unreliable narrator is such a...
Yes, and then... Exactly. And then you can play with that further and do all kinds of, as well as anyway. So it's very, very common to kind of take that default reading experience, to take the default viewing experience, right? Film viewing experience, and to tamper with it in the same kind of way is, I think, much more uncommon. Right. I mean, the default, because again, what the default situation is, right, is that you're sitting and you're watching a story, and what you're seeing is happening. You're seeing it. There's a kind of objectivity to it. Like, we can talk about point of view characters. That's a thing that's often discussed in discussing film or TV. But there's no such thing. It's not an actual point of view character. Like, we're not actually inside their head, seeing what they're seeing, usually, right? It's very, very rare, I think, mm-hmm. that we're getting, the camera is the eyes of a person. That would be a literal point of view character, and we never get that, right?
And it would make us sick in, 6 seconds of screen time.
Oh, my
time.
Goodness, yeah, I'd be, yeah.
I'm just thinking, being John Malkovich, I loved that film, but all of the shots where you're actually inside John Malkovich's head, it just doesn't work for very long, so don't make us do that.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. So again, the default, the thing that's happening, right, when you're watching a film, it's generally understood to be you're going to watch a story that is put together. Like, you're watching these things unfold. So you're entering into the sort of fictional frame of the story that you're watching, and the things that you see are, happening in this fictional world that is being created here, right? And of course, happening, usually the assumption, right? If you're not prompted otherwise, is they're happening in the order in which you're seeing them and whatever, right? Those are sort of the reality. And again, those can be tampered with in various ways too. And directors will play with that. But again, when I think about the levels of it, the frequency and the extent of the messing with that default parameter, it's just far, far more common and simpler to do with books. So back to the Peter Jackson trilogy, right? We don't get any of this kind of thing. Go ahead.
And let me just quickly answer D-May's question. D-May, you probably actually met Ben briefly because you guys were both Rings of Power in New York City premiere. So
yes,
there you go. So Ben is a studio director of Studio Lab, but he's also the director of Rings and Realms and the director of the Exploring Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings project that Corey and I are talking about right now. So this is a separate video project that we're doing for the Signum Collaboratory. So we're just kind of chatting through what the motivation for that series was. And we thought, why not do it on Tolkien Reading Day?
Tolkien Reading Day. Gondorian New Year. Exactly. Exactly. Anyway, so this is me going on about frames and stuff because...
But that was where we started this conversation, because the frame is so different from the film than what it is here. And that just started this conversation of why is it so different? And what were the thought processes between these two? And, the really simplified version, we've got a book where we're just bringing you into this world. You're not supposed to question it. Just start reading. And it's so nice to suspend that disbelief really quickly and just be engaged in the world. In the film, they got a lot of ground to cover in a very short amount of time. So it's more like a primer.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's even if you think about the question of what questions do they feel they need to answer at the beginning of the film? Compared to the questions that Tolkien seemed to feel he needed to answer. Even now, of course, the prologue was, as someone was mentioning earlier, the prologue was written later. The prologue came out with the I think it was released with the second edition of the Fellowship of the Ring. It wasn't part of the original story. It was written later on. It was definitely written after he wrote the whole story. But even then, so like both, if you look at the beginning of chapter one, which is how he begins the story when he starts writing it, or if you look at the prologue, which is how he chose to frame the story after the whole story was finished, in neither place do we get any of the kind of background that the Peter Jackson team felt they needed to include in the prologue sequence of The Lord of the Rings. We don't get any explanation of the making of the rings. We don't get any explanation of the Elder Days. We get no elves and dwarves and Battle of the Last Alliance. When's the first reference to the Battle of the Last Alliance? Chapter, in the book, I mean. Chapter 10? 11? Like when they get towards Weathertop, we start hearing about the Last Alliance a little bit. Gil-galad is, I mean, isn't it when Aragorn is reminiscing on Weathertop, when he's like, Elendil stood here to await Gil-galad at the coming of, do we get any references?
Is it not in Shadow of the Past?
Not the Last Alliance. Well, we get an allusion. We get Celebrimbor, but I don't think we get Gil-galad. I think we get a very indirect reference. Like, that's where he says, like, the power of the elves to resist him was greater than, right? Mm. And that paragraph. But it certainly does not tell the story. And absolutely does not tell the story of, like, the breaking of the sword and the cutting off of the ring and the, you know, Isildur taking the ring. And, like, we don't get any of that until book two, right? I mean, it's, like, none of that stuff is involved. Certainly not at the beginning, before, like, we've got to explain all these things before we go to Bag End, you know, with Gandalf at the beginning of the story. And yet the Jackson team felt like, okay, no, we need a prologue sequence, but in the prologue sequence, we're not going to do what Tolkien did in the prologue sequence. We're going to do a completely different thing. We're going to help people to understand. And I'm not saying it's like a bad or nonsensical decision. It's just a very different decision from the one that Tolkien made.
Does it achieve something similar on a film level, though? Because if you were to do that sort of explanation in a film, like it's done in the book, in Shadow of the Past or Council of Elrond or somewhere in there, you wouldn't get what is achieved in the film, where it's something similar, right? Where you're now listening to a story that's being told that is contemporary, right?
Right.
As opposed to just watching it happen.
Right.
The narrator's talking directly to you. I guess I never thought about it. They didn't have to do that.
No, they didn't.
I feel like there's something there about tone, right? Because if we had started the Peter Jackson trilogy the same way the text starts, it would have felt to me very Masterpiece Theater, sitting next to a fireside in my chair, opening a book and discussing academically the history. Whereas we're starting with this really powerful voice of an elf telling us this really gruesome and action-packed history over the course of 7 minutes. It's a different kind of hook.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they did that, but you would imagine there'd be some conversation around a table being like, how do we hook all these people that are not fantasy fans and have never read the Tolkien before? And one is a little more grabbing than the other.
Yeah, for sure. And you're absolutely right about Masterpiece Theater. Like, I couldn't swear that the narrator of the prologue has a leather armchair. Like, that might be a little high end for him. That's exactly the thing, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like
the pipe is in hand. We know this.
Yeah. Kind of stuffy modern academic telling us about his research is what we get in the prologue.
Yeah. And like even a little snooty about it. Like, well, obviously about that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he's relatively generous in his assumptions about what we know, which means he says all these things we have no idea what he's talking about if we're reading it for the first time.
Which is like anybody at a conference we've ever listened to in paper. Like, well, clearly you've heard of so-and-so.
right. Exactly. Now, I say generous because, you know, he's not doing a lot of, like, name-dropping and stuff like that, right? You know, the tone could be more over the top. But again, but that's exactly it. That's exactly the kind of frame that he gives to the prologue, right? But of course, the sort of perverse effect of that kind of distancing, like I'm going to talk from the frame of an academic sitting in an armchair, is to invest the story itself with greater reality.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it's a given. This stuff really happened. This is history, folks. This isn't even a work of fiction. So again, he messes with that scenario. Like, I thought I was picking up a fantasy novel, but it turns out I am, you know, picking up a work of like historical scholarship, actually, is what the prologue is kind of claiming. Right. So that's already being messed with now. So back to what Jackson's doing. Jackson is. They do convey, Ben, I'm coming back to what you were saying before. They do convey this, the sense of story, right? Like the sense of like the commentary on the history, instead of just starting straight in to the narrative. One thing I keep being tempted to say is like by doing the prologue, they prevent having to interrupt the story for a lot of exposition later on, as Tolkien, of course, very cheerfully does interrupt the story for like an entire chapter of exposition, essentially in chapter two. Except I guess if you're going to, instead of interrupting the story for exposition, you're just going to begin the story with like 10 minutes of exposition. You're not exactly skipping it, are you? You know, I mean, so yeah. Yeah. Yes. It does, but it does put things on a different footing, and it gives us particular prompts, right? And, you know, Maggie, I know this is some of the stuff that we talked about. One of the things that we discussed in one of the segments that we've already filmed for our video series on this is why they chose the particular voice they did, right? What is the impact of choosing Galadriel's voice for the prologue sequence, which is one of those things which, when you're very used to the film, feels inevitable, right? Like, well, of course, Cate Blanchett begins with the voiceover at the beginning. But from the perspective of the story, it is far from a given.
And they recorded multiple people on that. They weren't sure which one they wanted originally either.
Yeah. And we talked a good deal about the differences. We know that two of the other candidates, they recorded a Frodo intro, mm-hmm. right? An Elijah Wood intro, and they recorded an Ian McKellen version mm-hmm. of the intro. And either one of those can make really good sense, but has a very different effect. It has a very different impact on what we receive as viewers, like what we perceive is like being packaged for us, essentially.
Right. And like the authority that's brought to it. You know, I don't know if we would question it because we don't live in the world where Frodo gave the introduction, but I do wonder like how our perception of Middle Earth would have been colored slightly differently because we're getting it through Hobbit eyes, which is a really neat way to tell the story because that's such a driving force through the story. But because we got it through Galadriel's eyes, it comes with this like oomph, right? It comes with this real gravitas that we're getting this voice that has been around for a very long time and is an authority on a lot of the things that she's covering in this 7 minutes. Because was she there? We know Elrond was there, but
she was alive. But the only the only thing that the prologue at least claims she was there for was the distribution of the rings of power, right? We see her there,
but she just like, showed up for that part.
Yeah, she couldn't be bothered to show up at the Last Alliance.
I got my ring. Yep. I'm out.
She got hers.
Exactly. I'll be over here. Thanks. Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah. I mean, certainly she has. She was around, you know, in that whole time. But again, the way that so from that level, it makes a lot of sense. And the thing that I think I love most about the choice of the elvish frame is that it manages to, the fact that they have an elf framing the story and talking about the elder day, you know, like here's the ancient history that lies behind the story you're about to hear, does create a situation which is reminiscent of the textual situation, right, where Tolkien begins with the stories of the Elder, you know, the Elvish stories of the Elder Days, and the Lord of the Rings kind of emerges out of that. The film gives us, and we would certainly have, watching only the films, no other indication that the roots of the modern stories, like that the modern stories are connected back to these Elvish stories of the Elder Days. We get several places, usually from Sam, right, which remind us of that fact during the Lord of the Rings, even though we never, during the Lord of the Rings, if we didn't have the Silmarillion, which nobody had for more than 20 years after it was published, we wouldn't have any idea what most of those stories are, right? We wouldn't know who Beren and Lúthien are apart from the version, the very limited selection of their story that we get in the poem that Aragorn recites, and the quite impossible to interpret references to Turin Turambar and such like that. So the way that in which they create this historical Elvish frame, and that's where the story begins, right? That's the voice that we get is not only an elf voice telling us the early story, but even like the elf voices whispering in Elvish in the darkness, right, that we get at the very, very, like the very opening frames of the film. The work that they're setting out to do, that the two works set out to do in the prologues, right, in these opening sequences, are really very, very different kind of works given the kind of context that they have, right?
They are, but that just made me realize some of the similarities too. Like, what we need here is unquestioning immersion to the world and a belief in the authority of the voice. Mm-hmm. So for Tolkien's prologue, it was an academic. Maybe that's because Tolkien was an academic. You know, it's something along those lines of like, let me give you my lecture because I'm an Oxford Don. Whereas this is more fictional because we're participating in this world visually for the next 9 to 12 hours. And right, we're going to give you the elf that was there. So that is the authority on this story, yeah, not an academic.
So I think Tolkien isn't thinking about establishing authority, really. I think what he's providing is context on the publication history. Right? You are holding a book which has been published. You have heard of this other book called The Hobbit, which has been published. I am going to tell you, I'm going to contextualize these things for you so that you understand where this stuff came from and what this thing that you're holding in your hand is all about, right? And I think, by the way, I think it's also colored, his prologue is colored by the fact that Tolkien himself hated reading prologues before he started the book. Like, in a prologue that he was invited to write to an edition, was it a Morris? A William Morris book? I'm forgetting which book it was. Maybe it was a MacDonald. I forget. Either MacDonald or Morris. I forget which one it was. But one of their books he was invited to write an intro to. And he digressed into writing this whole essay about why you should never read the introductions to books before you read the books. instead, basically, you know, and he was like, whatever you do, stop reading this. If you've not read this book, stop reading it right now. Stop reading this right now and jump to chapter one, read the book, and then come back and read this, because it's perfectly ridiculous to read an introduction before you read the book itself. And so I think that some of his approach to the prologue is kind of sort of biased by his own inclination in that way. You know, by the way it's presented in the book, like, inescapably, this is the first thing that's given to the readers, right? Like, so if they're picking it up and paging through from the front cover and going through, this is what they will read first. But I do think that his own bias in which... like, he didn't really want people to do... I mean, the prologue really does make more sense if you've already read the book. And he's kind of... he's kind of, you will find that the academic narrator of the prologue is kind of addressing you more directly if you read it after you've finished reading The Lord of the Rings, and now you're wanting to understand what is the history, and even you're prepared to understand. You'll get the reference to the book, to the Red Book of Westmarch, right? Once you'll probably figure that. I mean, I don't think it's mentioned by that name. It's not mentioned by name during the course of the narrative of The Lord of the Rings, but you'll figure it out, you know, yeah, what he's referring to, and at least have an idea. But yeah, anyway, so that kind of complicates things there a little bit. Anyway, so back to what Jackson is doing. Dime is right. With an elf telling the background, it gives the story a depth that goes really far back in time. And I would say, Dime, again, like a thing that you can't take for granted, right? Assuming no background in Tolkien, if you're reading this, the association of elves with that antiquity, right? If you just had a Frodo frame, which in many ways makes much more sense, or rather would be more similar to how Tolkien frames the story, right? Here's the story as told by the hobbits, right? They wrote this in the West Book of, this all comes from the Red Book of Westmarch, which is the firsthand accounts of the hobbits who were involved in these stories. So if we're just getting like, I'm opening the Red Book of Westmarch and then I'm getting the film, right? It would be a Frodo frame. Like that would make perfect sense. But what we would lose is even the knowledge of the fact that, like, the depth that lies behind these stories comes from the elves.
Like, Phil references that, just letting us know that that deep time exists. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, just knowing that we have that longevity in this world and that there's beings that are still alive that can talk about it. Like, oh. You know, yeah. It just reminds me of that, I think it's Amy Sturgis did it in a science fiction lecture where she was like, the second a door is described as a portal door and goes like this, you know, it's such a subtle way to bring you into this world and going, oh, that's not normal, but it's normal to them. So all of a sudden I'm in a science fiction film, you know, right. Or a text. So yeah. What a nice way to be like, oh, I'm in a fantastic world because yes. This person's been alive forever.
Yes, exactly. And think of the payoff that has in the film. We haven't gotten here yet in our discussions, but I'm thinking of this scene when Sam and Frodo are seeing the procession of elves in the Shire, right? Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of things that scene would communicate all by itself with no context at all, right? But given the association that's already been made between elves and this deep time that Dime and Phil are talking about, between elves and authority, right? All of that now, like, when we are, as viewers, are kind of sitting there with Frodo and Sam, peeking through with them and watching the elves process by, it has a kind of impact that it wouldn't have had, I think, if we didn't have that prologue.
And especially the leaving part, right? Because they're leaving Middle Earth. So like, okay, great, they're done. Whereas with that prologue that we do have, you're like, oh no, they're giving right. up on Middle Earth. Like,
yeah, the history and the knowledge is all leaving too.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. We are losing touch with our past and our history. Like soon no one will be left who remembers these things. Again, as gets raised explicitly during the intro sequence itself. Sure.
I don't even know how long it is, so like we can just play a minute of it if you guys want to see it. So this is a super super rough cut. Like literally I just asked the editor for a very brief minute that we could show to just kind of give you a glimpse as to what we're filming. So there's no titles on it, there's no music on it, there's nothing formal shared on it yet. Where did I stick it?
Yeah, you should be able to screen share.
Okay.
Here we go.
See us?
I do.
All right, let's see if this works.
Hello. Thank you for joining us for this first element of our Exploring Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy. We are really excited to dive into this, but before we get going in the analysis, we really wanted to just kind of prep what you're about to see and what we're about to talk about. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the prologue in general. What is it? How is it put forward to us? What is framed and told in that story, and how do we receive it? How does that affect our interpretation? So let's get into that.
Yeah, I mean, as a framing device, this is a huge choice. There are several huge choices that are being made that really are going to set the tone for a lot of different things. So one of the things, of course, that we can notice right away, a difference we can immediately see about how the approach to storytelling is happening, is that, of course, the content of the prologue, the film prologue element, right, is mostly taken from the book, Chapter 2, right. The Shadow of the Past. Of course, so in the narrative, in the book, Tolkien, you know, introduces the characters and you know, we sort of start the drama with Bilbo not giving up the ring and stuff. And then we get the backstory, right? You know, we get this long chapter, which is the conversation between Gandalf and Frodo. And it's pretty clear that Jackson doesn't want to stop the momentum of the story in that way.
It's pretty tough to kind of rewind and then have all that action after you've already started something in one tone.
So the first thing that we get here is elvish whispering into darkness. So thinking back on the conversation Maggie and I had about this, it really establishes that's the starting point, right? The very first thing that we get is, before we get any visuals, it's almost like a kind of memory of the Ainulindale, this idea of singing the world into existence from darkness. It's not quite, because it's, you know, we're getting speaking instead of singing. But again, the way that the choices that the Galadriel choice really frames the elvish antiquity perspective, right? This is something that I think is really interestingly highlighted by the fact that literally before the very first visual shot we get, we hear elvish speaking in the background. I think this is a super important choice.
Okay, so let's take a look at some of the shots and the film elements that they've got to help tell the story of Lord of the Rings on screen. So we're going to start at the very beginning, and it opens with a lot of darkness. So we have a lot of time before we actually see anything visual, but that's very important. So we have this 28 seconds of just darkness before we see anything to tell the story. So that really encourages us to kind of shut off, to open our ears, to be receptive. It quiets down that outside world, and we only hear Kate Blanchett talking and giving us that introduction as Galadriel. And so we talked earlier on about how important that was to have Galadriel being the one framing our story. So to hear her coming in while we're settling into this story, just kind of absorbing ourselves into the darkness and having her frame us within that, it gives gravitas, right? It gives this extra level of oomph as we hear her voice come in and just settle us into the story of this is what's happening.
Cool. Oh, thank you to Matthias, our editor.
Yeah, that was fun.
That's great.
That was fun. Of course, I was going to say the last two sequences when you and I are talking separately there is what's going to be accompanying the actual visuals of the film there. So
yeah, so we'll actually be talking along with like an inset, right? Like there's going to be visuals of the film set into the screen, so you see both of us. Anyway, yeah. So there you go. That was a fun little clip, but that's basically like the short version of what we've been talking about tonight of just spending some time taking a look at the footage and discussing some of the decisions that Peter Jackson would have had to make in his adaptation and why did it happen that way, and let's take a look. So actually doing the play along.
Yeah. 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 So it has been really fun to think. I have been so much enjoying I really feel like this film, this discussing the films that we've been doing, the show that we're doing now, discussing the films, is like the sort of adventure in applying all the things that I've been learning from our discussions, Maggie, over the course of the last 2 years, right? And it has been I mean, everything that we've been doing has been so delightful so far. I have found it to be so, again, all of the conversations we've had and the way that it's changed my sort of understanding of adaptation and thinking about what's at stake in adaptation, has really made the experience of watching the film and commenting on it such a different experience than I ever would have expected. It's been so much more fun, so much less complaining, so much more analysis. It's just it's excellent.
That it's was excellent. The goal. Yeah, it's definitely not a making of trivia series. It's very much analysis, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were trying to figure out if there were ways that we could do it, because obviously I live in the UK and Corey lives in New Hampshire. It's like, oh, well, we could do this part separately, we could do that. But we happened to be together in February, and it was only like 3 or 4 hours over 2 days, and it was so much fun. And we just went through a bunch of stuff and really enjoyed talking about it. It's like, yeah, we're just going to wait to film until I'm back in New Hampshire, and we'll just get a lot done.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And here you are. So we're looking forward to getting back in the studio here at some point in these next couple weeks, which will be great fun. And folks who are interested in keeping up with this video project and following along both with the development and having some input in the development and, you know, kind of being a part of our team on that, as well as seeing all of the finished clips and stuff when things are completed and as we're rolling it out, can do so by joining us at the Signum Collaboratory. So that's collaboratory at signumuniversity.org. No, collaboratory.signumuniversity.org is what I mean to say. You can join us there. And that's where we are doing that and a number of other really fun projects. So,
yeah. Fun. Anything else you want to talk about tonight? I'm like, it feels like such a natural finish, but we never end 5 minutes early.
I know, right? It's a little bit strange, but we should probably take advantage of the momentum there. So next week we're going to go back to Arrakis, right?
Yes.
Because we're going to be bringing in two of our local Signum Dune experts to talk about Dune. We were really interested. We had a conversation with Dom Nardi and Trevor Brierley, the editors of a really fun book on Dune, which came out a little while back. Anyway, we had a really fun conversation with them about Dune adaptations before, when we were looking at different Dune adaptations, kind of bigger picture. And so we wanted to return with them and hear their perspective on the second Dune film, which I know Maggie and I have already talked about a good deal, but
there's really, I just need to keep talking about it.
And much more to say about
again,
that.
Again, yeah. Just to prepare. So it's going to be a different time, though. So it's April 1st at 9 p.m. That is not an April Fool's joke. It's 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So Phil, don't worry if you cannot stay up that late. That is insane.
It's okay, yes. We do apologize. I know, you know, we have many viewers who like to watch or listen from Europe, but I know it's going to be harder that day, but yes, when we have American guests, we often will need to accommodate that to change the schedule. So,
and I happen to be in this time zone, so let's just milk it. Yeah.
So it works. Exactly. Awesome. Exactly. Very good. So we'll look forward to that next week on the 1st at 9 p.m. Thanks for joining us. Ben, thanks for sitting in with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. And we look forward to getting in more work on our exploring Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy series as well. So thanks, everybody. And we'll see you guys next week. Bye now.